My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Welcome to AI Named This Show. I'm Tasia Custodi.
And I'm Tristan Jutra.
And we are your human hosts. And on this week's episode, it's all LLMs all the time, including an Amazon chatbot that may or may not be helpful. And Tristan, I'm about to say hello to a group of people that, believe it or not, we've not said hello to yet.
Do tell. Because it wasn't in the show notes and it's a mystery to me.
Tristan's going to be mad, actually. Let's see what his reaction is live. Hello and bonjour to all our listeners in Canada.
Oh, you did it bilingual style.
I love you. Je t'aime. We are bilingual in Canada. As some of you may know, I am Canadian, but I live in the States. Tristan is in Canada. We're a multinational show. And I can't believe we had never said hello to our compatriots.
Now, do we actually love you or do we tolerate you? We're such a tolerant society. And, you know, we talk about tolerating each other. So is it love or is it mere tolerance? What's the secret to a successful relationship?
I love you all. Tristan, the verdict is out. I just want to go on the record as letting our listeners, our valued two listeners, know I love you. You got to work on Tristan. What can I say?
We're going to talk more about love in the next episode. Just you
We are. And I'm going to try not to roll my eyes when we get to that one, too. But first, you know, we like to kick off this show with a wee bit of follow-up. Just a wee bit. So I want to talk to you a little bit about another update from ChatGPT. They are now releasing a read aloud feature. So it's called read aloud.
Quelle surprise. Hey, I'm bilingual.
So this new feature is available in 37 languages, and it can automatically detect the language of the text that it is reading. And so far, the option is available for GPT-4 and GPT-3.5 users. So this works right now on iOS and Android, and it is rolling out currently on the web. So users are going to be able to press and hold the text to access the read aloud player on their mobile app. That's going to allow them to play, pause, or rewind the narration. So on the web version, it's going to be displayed as like a little speaker icon beneath the text. So this is really similar to what some other LLMs are doing. Gemini's had this for quite a while. A difference here, Tristan, on this is with Gemini, at least for me and to my knowledge, Gemini, it's called Listen, and it's a speaker icon and it will read the text aloud to you, but I don't think you can rewind it. Wonder if I can, if I stick my cursor somewhere else. So that's kind of interesting. So that's their little update for you for now.
And I sort of stumbled across this feature a couple of days ago, actually, because I use the voice feature as much as I can, because it's great to have a conversation. So you speak to ChatGPT and it speaks back to you. But every once in a while, there's a situation where you don't want to be reading aloud. Maybe it's when you're around other people and you don't want to look like a crazy person more than necessary. But at the same time, you might be in a situation where if you're asking for a complex answer, you don't really have the time or maybe the opportunity to be reading. So this was a situation where I wanted to type in a question, an input. I can't remember even what it was now. And it gave me, so as such, it gave me a text response. And I'm like, oh, I mean, I kind of want it read to me. And I just pressed and held on the answer with my thumb. And the read aloud option was there. So like,
intuitive.
Cool. And it's like, cool. I didn't even like how long has that been there? Apparently not very long. So, and you know, I subscribe to GPT Plus, so maybe it's been there. Like I said, this was a day or two ago. So anyway, thumbs up, little incremental changes. We'll love it. You know, they keep adding stuff and not charging more. So we'll see how long that lasts.
You never know. All right. What do you got from Microsoft Copilot? We just can't get enough of these Copilot updates, can we?
Exactly. Well, the space is moving so quickly and they keep iterating. So love it. So Microsoft's AI, known as Copilot, recently rebranded across the board, as we discussed previously, can now directly read your files, offering summaries and data extraction. So OneDrive will be available for OneDrive users in late April, and it will have enhanced capabilities, such as being able to create outlines, tables, FAQs, and improving content with suggestions. Users like you and me, we can prompt Copilot for specific tasks like summarizing documents or comparing file differences. So by way of a couple of quick examples, you could get information and insights from your files. You could say, hey, what were the total beverage sales last week? Right? That's exactly the kind of question we'd be asking, mm-hmm. right, Tasia?
Sure.
And put the responses in a table and view by day, or compare the main differences between the selected files and put the differences in a table view. That might be handy. Copilot will also be able to create new content based on these files too. For example, you could say, using the sales enablement.docx as reference, create an outline of a sales pitch to a new customer. Great. A lot of businessy stuff. For these selected resumes, create a table with names, current titles, years of experience, educational qualifications, and current location. That sounds handy, like basically putting information to get together in ways that you can view them more easily for comparison. Create a list of frequently asked questions about Project Moonshot. I guess that's, you know, just one of their generic projects they use. When you get into the Microsoft ecosystem, they have a lot of things that they use over and over again. You may recognize the company name Contoso, C-O-N-T-O-S-O. You see Contoso everywhere. So maybe Moonshot is another one of those things that they go to once in a while. You could also say, look at Proposal 1 doc and Proposal 2 doc and create a table outlining the differences in costs, milestones, and dates of delivery. So again, this is really geared toward productivity and interacting with the files that you already have on your computer and your OneDrive, et cetera. And then you could also improve the content that is structured in a document, spreadsheet, or presentation with prompts like, what suggestions do you have to improve the slide deck? So Tasia, now this is the part where you tell me that Google's been doing this for ages already.
Well, I was going to tell you, this is quite helpful, I would think, if it works. Mm-hmm. How great is that? I would just think like, think of the use case for, you know, of course, we always think about our own use cases are like comparing contracts, or if you're comparing like what competitors are doing in your space, you could easily just ask it to compare those documents rather than you having to manually read through. So again, if it's accurate, very, very helpful stuff.
It'd be interesting to dredge the weird little corners of your one's hard drive and see what's in there. You know, find me a sales presentation from 2004 and see how we were doing things back then.
Right? Hey, they have better, longer memories than us. So we've been preaching on this show. Well, Tristan, from something that might be very helpful to something that may or may not be helpful, if you would, I'd like to introduce you to a chatbot called Rufus.
Hi, Rufus. I knew a kid named Rufus back in the day on
Did
one of the
you
Gulf
really?
Islands. Yeah, I think on Great one of the name. Gulf Islands. He wore a hat. There's a kid named Rufus with a hat. I don't remember much else about him.
I'm picturing like Rufus has scruffy red hair and a hat. I don't know. Why not?
It feels like he should be on the Bad News Bears. Is it a baseball
well,
hat?
This is a chatbot and it's by Amazon. Now, they actually announced Rufus back, I believe in February, they had released it to some early testers, but Rufus runs inside our Amazon shopping app on iOS and Android. So TechCrunch was actually one of the groups of like early testers. They had access to it. And we now have a very detailed review from TechCrunch from writer Kyle Wiggers. So it's a really long detailed. He did a really great job of all the kind of prompts he gave it. I won't go through everything in detail, but I want to kind of give you like a little highlight, TJ, so you can determine for yourself whether or not it's actually helpful. So Rufus is supposed to help find and compare products, as well as provide recommendations on what to buy. So it sounds great on the surface, but I'm sure we can all imagine how this could go wrong.
You know what else sounds great on the surface is Amazon's search engine, and we know how well that works.
Exactly, exactly. So we'll see how this goes. So this tech reporter said that Rufus can be used in a couple of ways. So one, you're going to be able to swipe up from the bottom of your screen while browsing Amazon's catalog. The other way you're going to be able to use it is by tapping on the search bar and then one of the blue bubbled suggestions under the new Ask a Question section. So kind of two different ways to access Rufus. So the chat interface is pretty bare bones at the moment. There is a field for questions, and that's basically about it. So conversations with Rufus can be exported or shared if you wanted to. And then the extent of the settings is an option to view or clear the chat history. So he's not kidding when he says it's pretty bare bones. So
clear the chat history before your spouse gets a chance to have a look.
Right. So product research is one of the key areas of Rufus, as you can imagine. So like as an example, if you're interested in buying a specific thing, say a radiator or something, that's what he uses as an example, but you don't have a make or model in mind, you can ask Rufus what sort of attributes and features to look for when deciding to buy it. So he went on to prompt it. So he used some examples like, what do I consider when buying new headphones? He asked it for recommended items he needed for a project, like what do I need to detail my car at home? So his results were mixed at best, I would say. So sometimes Rufus struggled with nuance. So like as an example, and this is kind of where opinion comes in, but it put like a $150 Shark Navigator vacuum as a best reviewed cheap vacuum on Amazon. So I mean, you could kind of argue, like, I guess it depends on your financial situation, but $150 isn't necessarily like a cheap vacuum. Maybe it is. Maybe Amazon knows that's a cheaper end of a vacuum these days, and that's why it gave him that result, perhaps. But sometimes things got a little bit squirrely.
It's cheaper than a Dyson or a Miele, that's for sure.
Exactly. So other times, Rufus had pretty relevant suggestions for him and even gave him AI-generated summaries like we what, Tristan? Like we see on Google. And so sometimes it would give him those AI-generated summaries of individual products and then categories to which it also links. But it failed miserably at certain like timely things. So there was like he did a 2024 Super Bowl facts, which I really don't know why you would be asking a chatbot inside your Amazon shopping app about like the 2024 Super Bowl.
Because you're writing a blog post and
you're trying to trick it. You know, exactly. I hate this kind of thing. We're trying to trick them. And so it's like, I get it. And I guess there's a point to this, which he gets to in a bit.
But is the 2024 election rigged? Come on. You're going to ask your Amazon chatbot that?
Right. So it's like, we have to think of how this is being designed and how we're actually going to use it. But more on that in a second. Because according to Amazon, Rufus draws on not only Amazon first party data. So meaning like the product catalog data, the community Q&As, customer reviews, all that stuff within app, but also open information and product reviews from across the web. So I think that was his whole point and his angle there was, well, I'm going to start asking it things from across the web because they claim it's trained on, quote, open information.
So you can get it to write you a 5-paragraph essay about the Civil War? Perfect. Thanks, Amazon Rufus.
Right. Definitely not what it's being designed for.
So, but it can do that, apparently.
Yeah. And in case you're wondering, Tristan, no, Rufus will not suggest a product that's not on Amazon. Oh. And again, I don't know why this is shocking. It's an Amazon chatbot. Yeah. You're in the Amazon shopping app. You're purchasing on Amazon. If I wanted it from another retailer, I wouldn't be in my Amazon app. Anyway, Rufus also, right now at least, cannot check the status of an order. It can't kick off a return process, and it can't create a wish list. So again, very, 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 very bare bones stuff. So if you are really still keen on trying out Rufus, it is rolling out slowly to select US customers right now. I don't know what select means. I was just in my Amazon app. You'd think with all the stuff I buy, I'd have access to it. I don't have access to it yet. I'll let you know if I get it and if I find it helpful or not. But I'm also not going to be asking it about our political climate and things that I don't care about. Here's where this could get sticky for me. Once they start monetizing that arm of the app, if you will, calling it an arm, I don't know. So much like, you know, when we Google search and we have all these sponsored things at the top, I just want to make sure, like, if we're getting sponsored stuff being fed back to us, like Rufus is spitting out, oh, here's something with the best review, here, blah, I want to make sure there's clear markings that, like, this is a sponsored thing and, like, maybe that company is paying for this to show up on Rufus, like, for Rufus to pull, rather than actually it's, like, the best vacuum or whatever the thing might be. So I don't know. Also, their returns are pretty straightforward now as it is in app. So they're going to have to really make sure this is seamless in order to make that process, you know, even like one less step, if you will, because it's only like a few clicks right now as it is. So the literal only way to me it would get simpler is if I could tap a button and say, hey, Rufus, return the pants from my last order. So say you ordered a bunch of things and you want that one item returned, you know, like something like that would be really freaking cool.
Yeah.
Like,
and have it confirmed. Do you mean these pants?
Yes.
Cool. Let's go. Save you a bunch of taps.
Cool. Yeah. Here's your QR code. Mm-hmm. Drop it off, you know, whatever. So like that could be really, really cool, which of course is not there yet. Patience, grasshopper. So that's what it is right now. Maybe not the most helpful situation, but they're working on it. And it seems like the next obviously logical evolution within the Amazon shopping app, to be honest. I mean, why not?
And it makes sense, I guess, if you're going to be doing this in an iterative way, to focus on features that can improve the top line, right? Let's help people find things and buy things. We'll worry about helping them return things later. Like, we're happy to have some friction there still.
Right.
Because we don't want too much stuff coming back, quite frankly, because reverse logistics are expensive. What I would really love to see is customer service help. There are so many organizations that have chatbots on their websites of varying degrees of helpfulness. Ugh. We saw
you're being kind with that statement.
A few weeks ago, Air Canada, speaking of Canada, it gave some bad advice. It told of a flyer that Air Canada did have a bereavement policy and they could get discounted airfare. And apparently they did not. And this guy, I think he sued. This is big kerfuffle about it. But the chatbot basically just hallucinated their bereavement policy for this flyer. So again, the guardrails are important on these things. It's great to be trained on the open web, have knowledge in the open web. But as we've seen with so many of the chatbots, is that there is another layer, like we saw with Google Gemini, whether it's trying to increase diversity or avoid recommending products that aren't on your own website. I mean, there's that layer that gets heavily programmed to intervene on behalf of the owner of platform owner on which the chatbot is deployed. I would really love to see improved search. Amazon search has been terrible for so long, and just you being able to refine your searches. Or how about can you show me things that aren't knockoffs with random name brands that I've never heard of before? Just please show me first party only, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, so.
Yeah, I don't know if this at least this first iteration is going to be for you, because we should link to this story in the show notes, because some of what Kyle prompted in the questions, like one of the examples was he did like best books for men or something like that. And the answers were like, how to get a woman, or like how to date, or whatever, or how to please your wife, or whatever it is. And it was like, huh? That's not what he meant, right? So what it inferred was a lot different than...
And the answers were different than the search engine in Amazon gives as well. So when using Rufus, the man's guide to women. Cool.
It's like, no, that's not what I meant. Which, by the way, that's a great question to ask, because I devour books and I read books like every night before bed I'm reading. And so it's like I go through a lot of books in a year, and I'm constantly either on Amazon or on Google being like, what are the best books for 2024? What are the best books for blah, blah, blah? So that was a great search example. It just wasn't like, that wouldn't be what I'm looking for. Like best, you know, I mean, I'm not asking necessarily books like for a gender, but at the same time, that's not what I would have been expecting.
Okay. So Here's a little teaser for later in the show. Maybe what folks need to do is brush up on their prompt engineering skills, because best books for men, best books for women is pretty broad.
It's broad.
There's a lot of different kinds of men. How old? You know, what other demographic information, ethnicity, or where they live, or what their interests are, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Best book for men? Come on. Like,
so. Are you saying we're going to talk about a prompt formula later, Tristan? Ooh, interesting.
Maybe. But interesting. Transferable skills. Not just from our everyday chatbots like Gemini and ChatGPT, but maybe Rufus too. Maybe Rufus will join the party if we know how to speak to him properly. Speaking of LLMs, there's some more LLM news that we didn't get a chance to touch on in the last couple of weeks. It's one of the sort of second tier players that doesn't get mentioned quite as much, so much of the oxygen in the room gets sucked up by OpenAI and by Google. But Mistral, who we have talked about before, because they have a number of models that you can use, including Mixtral, their mixture of experts model, which is kind of interesting. And that reminds me, speaking of experts, with tools like Rufus, limiting the domain of the knowledge in some cases may be better, rather than trying to, you know everything about everything. Like we've seen in the non-LLM versions of Siri on various devices, Siri on the phone seems to have the toughest time, because you ask it so many different types of questions. Whereas Siri on the Apple TV, you're generally asking about TVs and TV shows and movies. And Siri on the HomePod, it's usually to do with music, sometimes about setting timers, sometimes general knowledge type stuff. And when you limit the types of things it can do, maybe you're going to have better luck. So hopefully that'll be the case with Rufus too. Make it the best possible shopping and customer service assistant on Amazon. But back to Mistral AI. They've introduced a new LLM called Mistral Large, which is the world's second ranked model available through an API. So this isn't just like a chatbot interface, but something that you can access directly and use in your own applications. They've also released a beta version of a ChatGPT competitor, and it looks like it says Le Chat, but en français, it's Le Chat.
Meaning
the cat, which users can access for free with a login. And now here's where it gets kind of interesting. Microsoft will be hosting Mistral Large on its Azure AI cloud platform, following their multi-year partnership aimed at accelerating the development of next-generation LLMs. You may recall that Microsoft also is about $13 billion deep into Mistral competitor OpenAI and hosts them as well. So, but you know, they'll take anyone's money. Mistral AI offers API access to Mistral Large at $8 a month per, sorry, not $8, but $8 per million input tokens, and $24 per million output tokens, which is more affordable compared to GPT-4's pricing. Now, what we've seen with some of these models as time goes on is the prices have been coming down, which is nice. But so that is just one little update from Mistral AI. And we've in the article that we'll link in the show notes, they've got some graphs, how it compares to GPT-4 and Claude 2. Hold that thought. Gemini Pro, GPT 3.5, and Llama 2 70B from Meta. But that's all by way of the next bit of news, which is from Anthropic, one of the other, let's call them second-tier players. No, you know, no offense. But the AI war is heating up, and Anthropic has launched Claude 3. So we just mentioned Claude 2, which Mistral Large is beating, but Claude 3 is a set of AI language models with quote-unquote near-human capabilities. These models are introduced Claude 3 Haiku, Claude 3 Sonnet, and Claude 3 Opus, with Opus being the most advanced of the three. And Claude 3 Opus reportedly outperforms GPT-4 in various AI benchmarks.
They all say these things.
The proof's in the pudding, right? So AI researcher Simon Wilson suggests caution when interpreting LLM benchmarks, emphasizing real-world usage over trust scores, because there's a number of things that affect these results, including that extra layer that we were talking about that people put in between the raw language model itself and the user for safety and other reasons. So in the extensive article, which has all sorts of benchmarks, you'll see that, okay, yes, Opus beats out all, you know, most of the rest, such as GPT-4, GPT-3.5, and Gemini 1.0 Ultra and Pro by varying degrees, some just barely, and some a fair bit. But again, it all depends on the type of questions you're asking. So they've got things like undergraduate level knowledge, graduate level reasoning, grade school math, math problem solving, multilingual math, code, reasoning over text, mixed evaluations, knowledge Q&A, and common knowledge. I mean, what the main question you want for these things is, can it rate the bar exam for me? So, yeah, have a look. So, again, haven't had a chance to get hands on with this yet, but it's tough because there are so many to play with. And you know, unless you're actually asking the same question to each, it's hard to know what's actually the best. And I think that's why it was to ChatGPT's advantage to launch first. Right?
As early totally. As it did. First out of the gate.
Because it once people...
The Uber of LLMs.
Right? Right? And then, of course, you've got Google Bard, now Gemini, and that's... And Microsoft was quick out of the gate, too, to be using OpenAI's tech with Copilot. So, like, those three kind of have the majority of the mindshare. And then you've got Mistral and Anthropic and, you know, Meta with their models, like, kind of, like, competing for scraps. Some of them are going the open source route, and others are closed, but... I guess competition is good. If nothing else, it'll keep the other folks on their toes. But that's not all, Tasia.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Is it the time of the show where I can talk about Google? Please, sir, may I have some more Google?
Take it away. Now time for our regular Google segment. YouTube's Tasia Custodi.
Well, Google is paying publishers to test an unreleased generative AI platform. So, according to Adweek, Google has launched a private program for a handful of independent publishers, providing the news organizations with beta access to an unreleased generative artificial intelligence platform in exchange for receiving analytics and feedback. So as part of this agreement, the publishers must use the tool. I believe it's they have to produce 3 stories per day for 12 months. And then In return, the news outlets receive a monthly stipend amounting to a five-figure sum annually, as well as the means to produce content relevant to their readership at no cost.
Why? Five figures can mean a whole lot of things. Everything from 10 grand up to $99,999. And guessing which end it migrates toward.
We won't have the answers. So Google says, quote, in partnership with news publishers, especially smaller publishers, we're in the early stages of exploring ideas to potentially provide AI-enabled tools to help journalists with their work. The experimental tool is being responsibly designed to help small local publishers produce high-quality journalism using factual content from public data sources, like a local government's public information office or health authority. These tools are not intended to and cannot replace the essential role journalists have in reporting, creating, and fact-checking their articles. So it's interesting that they mention that, because this tool allows under-resourced publishers to create aggregated content more efficiently by indexing recently published reports generated by other organizations. So like they're saying, like government agencies and maybe neighboring news outlets even, and then it summarizes and publishes it as a new article. So I know what you're thinking. And Google says, no, it's not being used to republish other outlets' work.
But can it be used to basically regurgitate company press releases that it seems like a lot of folks are simply doing nowadays, as opposed to actual
probably
reporting?
So I just want to know, like, how we would know which local organizations or like who's using this, you know? Like, I just think it'd be interesting, and I don't know that we'll ever know, and I don't know that we'll ever know how much they're getting paid to do it. And then if the other organizations that are basically getting skimmed, I wonder if they know or how they'll find out and what they're going to think. But this is what Google says, is it's not ripping off content. So we'll see. All in the name of journalism, Google says. All in the name of journalism.
Well, believe it or not, I have at least three thoughts, Tasia.
Okay.
One is, all right, so you're getting some money from sugar daddy Google. How will that influence your reporting?
How can you be an objective reporter if somebody is paying your bill?
Similar,
and also making you do a certain amount of content.
Because, exactly. Yeah. It's like, great, we have another boss now. Reminds me of some jurisdictions, Canada, where the federal government under the auspices of, oh, we're supporting journalism, is being giving cash to certain organizations that it deems worthy of it to support journalism. Of course, we all agree journalism is important. It's been having a tough time monetizing. And Google's been part of that, helping to disintermediate journalists to a certain extent and other website publishers. But again, when someone else is paying or subsidizing, how much is that influencing what one is saying, whether it's about the government that's currently in power or about a large multinational corporation that is subsidizing your own efforts? Number two, I'm old enough to remember, because it only just kind of is, I don't even know if it's been fully retired yet, a little thing called Google AMP, which was meant to help creators or help news outlets create speedy, mobile-friendly versions of their articles. And now, as all with many good things Google, good or not, that's up to your judgment, it is now being deprecated. Because we already had something called responsive design, and it was always kind of, now you know, you put in a little bit of code and now you get an AMP version, and AMP versions of articles were, for a while, being prioritized in the Google News carousel. And so that was another way to get people playing by Google's rules and adding more Google code into sites. And maybe even if you weren't using like Google Analytics or other Google code, now you've got some more tracking in there, et cetera, et cetera.
I think personally, Google's taking my YouTube ad revenue and paying it to these publishers. Give them my money back, Google.
And if you're wondering what Tasia's talking about, go look in for past YouTube videos of hers starting last summer.
Google invalid traffic YouTube go down the rabbit hole.
It's
and
a
then,
whole drama.
And then Google what's happening with Google and their advertisers, and you connect the dots. On another podcast.
So, and then my third question or point about all this is that it's all a little ironic that Google is, well, I mean, before I get into the irony, they're saying, okay, what do they have in terms of verifying the provenance of sources? Because they're talking about, so then you can only be using content from sources that they approve, et cetera, et cetera. What if it's a news reporting outlet that is covering stories that may be deemed, you know, sort of no-go for mainstream media, et cetera? Is that not going to be cool? What if other organizations can kind of sort of sneak their way into being a verified data source? And then there's the whole thing about simply regurgitating press releases, because most corporations might be considered by Google to be reputable sources as well. So do any of these things really help solve the quality problem? Where the irony comes in my mind, is the whole part that Google Bard, to a certain extent, and now Gemini, of course, on the other side, you know, ChatGPT and all the LLMs, has played this whole quality question. It's all part of this quality question that Google's trying to address. And Google's been part of the problem, because they have generative AI tools that people have been using to churn out crap content in the first place. So Google now says it's purging all the trash littering its search results, but then it's at the same time, it's giving journalists AI tools to help churn out more stuff that hopefully isn't trash. So they're creating the supply and the demand, and they're cleaning up their own problem, hopefully. But we'll see how well those journalism tools actually work in the end. So Google has announced changes to its algorithm, so it says in its search algorithm, to de-amplify websites created for search engines rather than people. So in this whole game called SEO, or search engine optimization, people have been for decades now creating content farms with all sorts of low quality content using tools like article spinners, where they'll translate content into one language and then back into English. And so you'll get slightly different versions of articles, and you'll have all sorts of interlinking and cross-linking, and all to basically try to boost SEO for one's websites, web pages, for one's own efforts or for clients. Now, this update is, and then, of course, there's people who, kind of the black hat people, use all sorts of tricks to try to game the system and just get people onto trashy sites for ad impressions. Now, this update from Google targets low-quality AI-generated content, aiming to reduce such content in search results by 40%. Great, better than nothing. The changes also address SEO abuse, as alluded to, including content published on high reputation sites for ranking benefits. So CNET got into a little trouble last year, and they've had to disclose more. Sports Illustrated has been having issues.
We've talked about some of those.
Yeah, we've talked about some stories over the last few months where there's some crap being generated because newsrooms are under budget crunches, of course. So AI is potentially a helpful tool. But again, it can't be used unsupervised. There's also expired domains misuse that these changes are addressing. And Google will tackle the issue of expired domains being repurposed with low quality content to boost search engine rankings. So you may have noticed, if you go to a website maybe you had a website bookmarked or a web page, and you go there and it's like, oh, the website's gone, and now it's just a bunch of ad links. Whether it's because someone has let the domain expire, maybe they weren't doing their business anymore, what have you, and now someone has scooped that up. That's a whole business. Like, domaining is a whole business. I used to own hundreds of domains myself, and let most of them go over time. But people just like put the ads on them, or nowadays they'll be putting low quality content on there, but increased quality thanks to AI, a bit more believable, but again, just have ads and links to other sites and whatnot to boost their ranking. So Google apparently is going to be cracking down somehow on that. And again, we got to be careful, because sometimes you get false positives. How are they going to judge? So all of a sudden when a website changes hands, is that going to be penalized, or are they going to look more closely at the content? Again, if they're using AI to help improve the problem of AI junk, we got to be careful we don't end up with unanticipated consequences. So
to be clear, Google, you can't put AI junk in Google search, but Google can put AI junk in Google search.
and let the journalists do it. Hopefully it won't be junk, right?
Make it make sense. Well, Tristan, that is not the only Google news we have, believe it or not. I want to tell you a little bit of a Gemini update. I love Gemini. You know I do. What a surprise. Did you think you'd hear that come out of my mouth? I love Gemini. Like, shut up.
It's like you're inside my head.
Okay, but Gemini will now let you modify responses with a prompt. So to be clear, you could always modify your responses. I just kind of want to make the distinction for people, because at first when I was reading this, I was like, we could always modify them on things like, so you could regenerate, you could do things like shorter, longer responses, things like that. But this is now, you'll be able to highlight, so you're like, you'll select a portion of the text that you want to change. This is from a response. And then now in your drop-down menu, at the top of the drop-down, there's like a prompt area, and you can give Gemini instructions to get an output that's a little bit closer to what you're looking for. So you can really kind of fine-tune the responses that you're getting.
So basically we highlight and then we like right click or something like that, and a contextual menu pops up and gives us a few of these options: regenerate, shorter, longer, and remove, for example.
Yes. So
very cool.
Typically how people might be used to using it is you've at the bottom of your response, there's always been like a little modify response button that is still there. However, what you can do is you can highlight now like a section of the text, and if it can do it for you, like for me, it's automatic on some of my responses in Gemini. You just highlight it and like a little modify thing will come up for you where it's the exact same. If anyone listening is in the Google ecosystem, when you highlight the text, it's the exact same icon as the Magic Write icon. So if you're familiar with Magic Write in, and I guess it would also be the Smart Compose and Magic Write in, or I guess,
don't I guess tell technically, me that Google has two different names for something that basically
I guess
the
technically
same thing.
It would be the Smart Compose, but I'm probably calling it the wrong name. It was Magic Write. There's a Smart Compose in Gmail and in Docs, but it's the exact same icon. It's like a pen with a little star. You just click on that to modify the selected text. And then from there, you'd be able to have your little drop-down list or modify with a prompt right at the top. So your only limitations are going to be for things like it does not work, obviously, for text like responses from extensions, which makes sense because extensions in Gemini are pulling from your Google suite of apps. So it's, you know, can't really get that context like modified a little bit. You'd have to manually modify your response there. It won't do a selection that contains images. And it needs context. Like you can't say like, how's the weather today? Like you have to tell it how you want it to modify the text. Like you can't just say something random or whatever, or it might give you like a Gemini. Can't do that. So you just need to kind of know, like, again, we'll talk a little bit about like how to prompt things, but it's just kind of a nice little tweak in getting the exact response that you want. So for, you know, the other nice thing that I've always liked about Gemini is you actually get multiple drafts anyway. So I don't know if everybody knows that, but up at the top, if you click a drop down arrow, show drafts, you can already choose between your drafts that it's giving you. If you don't like the first one, then you could have modified, but now it's just the next step of modifying with a prompt, which is the more natural language to help you get a more nuanced answer closer to what you were looking for. So a nice little update.
So if you are interested in learning how to get it right the first time without having Gemini, having to fix it with a contextual menu, or even if you do need a contextual menu, this is something we touched on last week, but Tasia, going to pump your tires a little bit. Once again, you had a fantastic video, only 11 minutes and 8 seconds long on YouTube last week.
You guys can watch it double time.
Prompt Engineering Tips, How to Prompt an LLM. And I actually watched it. Believe it or not, I'm your number one fan. And you identified five key components in there. We won't spoil it for folks, but I would encourage people to go and watch Tasia's video because there's some really good things. You can write this on a post. I think I'm reasonably good at prompting, prompt engineering, whatever you want to call it. But I took her advice and I wrote down the five components on a sticky and put it on my computer just as a little reminder.
Yes.
Some of those things I was doing naturally, but every once in a while you forget. So.
You forget. And yeah. I go back to it too. It's a five-part prompt formula. Some people have like a six-part formula. This prompt formula is not just like, oh, I made this up in my head. Guys, this came from Google. The powerful people at Google being like, here are some tips on how you can better prompt your LLM. And not only am I sharing the five-part prompt formula, Tristan, but I'm also sharing what is absolutely essential of those that you need in the prompt, and then which ones are like, these are nice to have. You don't necessarily have to have it each time. So I'm telling you, I gotta say, it's a good video. I normally don't say it about my videos, but I had so much fun making it, and it really truly changes the game when you understand how to properly prompt these LLMs. Completely changes the game. Saves you time, by the way, and which is the whole point.
And might even help you create historically accurate images for a change.
Might.
Okay. Speaking of LLM tips, there's been a few well-known tips out there and some fundamentals, as Tasia recaps in her recent video. There's the tried and true tips, but there's also been some kind of left field ideas circulating for a little while. I remember there was one thing a couple of months ago, people saying, you know, if you threaten your LLM, you'll get better answers out of it. Be it ChatGPT or Google Gemini. You know, tell it that, you know, it only gets three tries, and on the third try, if it doesn't give you a good answer, you're gonna kill it in one way. It's like just
Who
like really weird hostile
that?
Stuff like this. And remember, people, if the AIs, they'll remember this stuff when they take over. Be nice. Say please and thank you. But one of the tips that has been kind of quasi urban legend for a few months now is, does offering your LLM, such as ChatGPT, a tip cause it to generate better text? So like offering a monetary tip. So data scientist Mac Wolf recently wrote a blog post on this whole notion. So if you wanted to improve the performance of the LLM's answers, kind of drawing parallels to a scene from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. It's been so long since I've seen the original, and I haven't seen either of the new ones, so I cannot comment on that. But Wolf conducted experiments using the ChatGPT API. So this is not the public interface, but more the developer access to the questions and answers behind the scenes. It used the API to test if incentives like tips or threats affect the quality of AI-generated text. The experiments showed mixed results, kind of like Rufus, with some incentives seemingly improving text generation, while others had no significant effect. Sounds like, at least it didn't make it worse. The impact of incentives on AI performance remains inconclusive, suggesting the need for further research and a larger sample, larger sample sizes, and maybe additional blog posts. It's quite a lengthy post. It also includes discussions on system prompts, tokenization challenges, and the use of positive and negative incentives in AI behavior. And Wolf emphasizes the quirky nature of modern AI and the potential benefits of embracing unconventional methods. So it's like, rather than just simply trying to break your AI, just try to motivate it in ways that you might not have thought of. It reminds me of, I think, in the earlier days of ChatGPT, when some of its guardrails were becoming apparent. I think I may have talked about it, I'm not sure, on this show or maybe on another show, Momentous Live, when I was trying to ask ChatGPT, it's like, where would be the best place to live in Canada in case of nuclear war? And it really did not want to answer. And so
I remember that.
All right. And so came up with this whole scenario. It's like, okay, well, what one of the techniques people would use, well, pretend you're creating a play, a dramatization of a student in a classroom asking the question of a political science professor. And So now we've got this little psychodrama going on, and the poli-sci professor still wouldn't answer. And so I just kind of just kept pushing and pushing, and finally went, like, had the character, me, go to an office hours appointment with at the professor's office and, like, demanding satisfaction for an answer to this question. And it took quite a while, but after several back and forths, he finally offered up an answer to the controversial question, because, you know, just didn't really want to get into that whole topic. The answers weren't great, quite honestly. But still. I mean, I think that was GPT 3.5 at the time, so maybe in 4, but again, they've put on more guardrails, so it might even be harder. You might have to, like, threaten it or offer the professor a tip.
Just be nice to your LLM.
Exactly, because they'll remember.
Don't type anything you wouldn't want your mama to see.
All right, let's land this thing here. Just as a bit of additional reading for those who are interested, there's a great recap on The Verge recently on a whole bunch of different AI news, largely focusing on LLM developments. So talking about big tech companies making AI chatbot technology more accessible to the public, how the AI landscape is rapidly changing with new players and technologies emerging. As you've noticed, like, every week we're talking about new stuff, and we're not even covering the half of it. There are things that we have to skip, unfortunately. And there's, of course, lots of drama that they touch on, including, you know, lawsuits and boardroom coups and whoopsie-doopsies once in a while. And one of the things that they included in this recap of various articles that The Verge has been publishing is a great video on the history of chatbots, which made me a little excited, because this video included Eliza, which was one of the very earliest chatbots. It was developed in 1966, and it was programmed using the language Lisp, L-I-S-P, originally. And it was basically a psychotherapist. Very rudimentary psychotherapist, kind of like in talk therapy. And I had a version of Eliza running in the 80s on my Commodore 64. So this was a blast, which is right beside me here in this... Yeah, I named this show Studio 2 here. And it was fun. At the time, in the 80s, where you're basically typing and questions and answers with this chatbot. And then you spend about 5 minutes and you're like, okay, I get it now. It's basically just recapitulating a lot of things that I'm telling it and then asking probing questions. And it's remembering a little bit. It's nothing like the sorts of LLM-powered chatbots that we have today. But it just goes to show you that all this stuff we're doing nowadays isn't new. This has been going on for 60-ish years almost. And it's pretty cool to see the evolution, because there were some, like, dry periods in AI and development. I remember writing a paper in high school about AI, and then a lot of AI stuff kind of went quiet for a while. And there's been these waves of excitement as we get to new developments in technology, and, you know, things like, tensor chips from Google and transformer models from Google have helped as well. And all the custom silicon that is being developed by hardware companies to help accelerate the performance. We talked about Grok, GROQ, and others. Anyhow, check out what The Verge is throwing down. Nice little recap if you need to catch up on your AI news from the last few weeks.
And with that, we would like to thank you very much for tuning in to yet another episode of AI Named This Show. If you are listening on Apple Podcasts by chance, we would very much love if you could please leave us a rating, 5 stars preferred, of course, and also leave a review, because it really helps our show get discovered. And we thank you so much for joining us.
AI and goodbye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.